Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. So this episode, we're actually going to be covering a pretty big topic. So we're going to be talking about sexuality in paganism. And I suppose in general as well. So welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Yes, it's certainly a big topic. It's big for humans and other animals that reproduce sexually, which doesn't mean it's all that big in the grand scheme of things. But for us, it seems to be a really big deal. So we're going to do what we can to dissect it and talk about how our mainstream culture views it, how our pagan subculture views it, and how we think the future might look.
Yep. And we chose it for now because this is right after Beltane. It's in, for many of our listeners who are in the Northern Hemisphere, this is spring. This is a time that is really associated with sexuality and beginnings and all of that.
Yes. In the agricultural cycle of the Northern Hemisphere, this has been the time of sowing. And simultaneously, it's been the time when it finally got warm enough to go outside and play around. Mm-hmm. So that combination appears to have been conflated, at least in the minds of people creating modern paganism in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, into Beltane being a very sexual kind of holiday, a celebration of sexuality and of the genitive impulse. Mm-hmm. So that is why we're addressing this topic at this time. Besides that, we're complete whores for listeners, and having a prurient topic is probably about the best way to go about that. So we'll proceed from here.
Sounds good. I'll take a look at the stats and let you know how that, if our guest turns out. So, yeah. So were there other things you wanted to add about the season? Because we did talk about sort of beginning with discussing the spring in that way.
We did. You know, it's an interesting time because obviously, different creatures have different life cycles. And so a lot of birds are laying eggs right now. There's a lot of mating happening in the bird world right now. Mm-hmm. Whereas for many ruminants, like cattle and sheep and goats and so forth, they're done. They're having their little babies right now. They've gone through that cycle. They mated last fall. Mm-hmm. So it really... As with so much about the living world, it's a multifaceted gem, and you can look at it through many different angles in order to understand it. My personal fascination with this topic, other than just being a human, is that this is such an important drive for us. Mm-hmm. It's a hunger in the body, like a hunger for food or a hunger for water or a hunger to need to pee. It's something that has so much of an urgency to it. Mm-hmm. Not like our draw for art or music or even good flavors necessarily. You know, we will eat pretty much anything that we can eat if it'll keep us alive. Mm-hmm. This is rooted much deeper in ourselves, in the reptilian part of our brains. And I find that simultaneously really fascinating. And as someone raised in Western civilization, kind of challenging and shameful, because in this society, being in control of yourself is put at a very high premium. Mm-hmm. You know, Does that make sense? The sense that you should not be carried away by your impulses and your passions.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a huge focus for us. I think that relates a lot to, you're saying the control, that we should be in control, or at least some of us, because I think when we're going to start talking about some of the challenges in mainstream culture around sexuality, that that's one of the ways that we control each other.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And so that is also, that's where I think some of the shame comes in as well, when someone is experiencing that, those drives, or indulging. And even by saying indulging, that's revealing some of our cultural bias to even call it indulging.
Exactly.
That there's a loss of control for whoever's trying to control them, whether that's themselves or the society or the family member that has been assigned that role.
Yes. And there's also something that's very deep about the relationship with the self that has to do with sexuality as well, because we are primed to try to be attractive,
mm-hmm.
whatever that means to us. We groom ourselves, conduct ourselves in particular ways out in the public sphere in a way that we believe will be attractive to others.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is rooted in this sexual impulse. And it's, when you reflect on it, it's really extraordinary how ubiquitous and far-reaching this topic really is, how much of our lives it really consumes.
An amazing amount, yeah.
It really does. And so I feel very strongly for people that are asexual, and there are people who are asexual,
mm-hmm.
Because it's mystifying to them. This elaborate dance that so many of us are going through, and they're like, what? I don't get it. I don't know what they're doing out there, but it doesn't make any sense to me. So I guess maybe we should dive into our questions and explore this topic that is so complex and challenging and interesting to us.
I think so. Yeah.
And I want to say to start with that one of the defense mechanisms that I experience in myself and I see out in the society a lot around talking around sexuality is to get really clinical and technical. It's a way that we depersonalize the sexual realm because it is so intensely personal that it's threatening to us. And I'm going to try not to do that. I'm going to try to speak from my own experience as much as I can. And that doesn't mean that I'm going to go into great details about what particular things I like in sex. Not that I'm ashamed of those, but that I think that it would be a big distraction from the real point of this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that, I'd like to talk a little bit about the mainstream society before we talk about pagan values and particularly non-theist pagan values around sexuality.
Hmm.
We are not a healthy culture when it comes to relating to sex. The Abrahamic religions are so filled with this dualistic idea of the soul being sacred and the body being profane, and all of the ramifications of that, that therefore the things that the body loves are somehow dirty or lesser or something to be ashamed of. And you look at those mainstream Abrahamic religions and they are filled with all these largely arbitrary rules around what kind of sex you're allowed to have and with whom and when. And not to put too fine a point on it, it's all bullshit. The truth is that people have sexual impulses that vary in myriad ways. One of the statistics that I read, oh, a couple of months ago, something like that, in relation to paraphilias, a paraphilia is a sexual obsession of some kind. Mm-hmm. And it can be with a particular act, or it can be around a particular kind of object like shoes or feet. It can be any of a, or it can go into, you know, issues around power and humiliation and pain and pleasure mixed and all those kinds of things. 85% of the population has paraphilias that go beyond the desire for simple penis, vagina, intercourse.
Mm-hmm.
85% of the population. And the thing that that tells us more than anything else is there ain't no normal. There is no such thing. There is just not normal. And we desperately flog ourselves as teenagers, wondering if we're normal because we want X or we dream of Y. And it's a lie. It's just a terribly destructive, debilitating lie that we do to ourselves.
Mm.
So that's kind of my preamble for talking about the mainstream culture and sex. How about you, Arwen?
Yeah. So many places to go with that. I think jumping back to what you were saying about the Abrahamic approach of the separation between soul and higher self and the animal and the, you know, base and lowly, which is still very much reflected in our language. And we'll get into this later with some of the when we get into talking specifically about paganism, but I still see that in our language and paganism a lot as well. You know, we're on a higher vibration or a higher plane or, you know, yes, our higher selves, all of these, this vocabulary that's designed to separate ourselves from the earth. But there's, to me, there's a very funny irony in all of this. And that is, we like to try to separate ourselves from other animals, from the rest of the earth. And yet our obsession with sex and all of the things that we do, the making ourselves attractive and all of the attention that we put into it is something that humans do much more than most other animals. We spend much more time as that's, and it's part of our, I believe it's instinctual. It's part of who and what we are as animals, but that we are very unique in the amount of time that we spend on sex. Perhaps maybe some of our other cousins, bonobos, might be in that group with us, but most other animals, it's not that big a deal. But for us, it's everywhere. And we don't, a lot of what we do, I think, is connected with sex, but we don't even, it's so wrapped up in all of these decorations and trappings in our culture that we don't even recognize anymore that that is what it really comes down to.
Yes. Some of that may be because we mate year round.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're constantly trying to attract mates, whereas animals that have a particular, mating season cycle,
mm-hmm,
they just, you know, they grow antlers and, you know, bat them against one another or do whatever it is that they need to do,
yeah,
in that particular season. And then they get over it and they go off and do the rest of their lives.
Yeah. And, you know, I wonder if that's connected. I mean, all of this is connected, but to, as mammals, we also have very little sexual dimorphism. Males and females are not very different in size. There are some differences, right? And different, you know, on average, males are a little bit larger and have more, a little bit more upper body strength. But comparing that to some of the other mammals, the differences are very, very small.
They are.
And we don't, some of our social structures are much more egalitarian. It's in some species, like if we start, we were talking about cattle before, or we could talk about lions, you know, it's very clear when there's a dominant mating male, wherein with humans, that's, you know, everybody gets a chance.
Yes. And there are fascinating physiological pieces that go along with that. One of the most thought-provoking things in the era of sexuality, in the area of sexuality that I've heard, was Dan Savage, who is a sex columnist. His column is called Savage Love, and he's a gay man, and he's funny, and he's really right on in terms of his kind of agony column approach to people writing in about their sexual issues, right? And two of the things that he pointed out that I found really fascinating and thought-provoking were, first of all, a huge cascade of hormones pours into a man's brain to put him to sleep immediately after sex, immediately after orgasm.
But not for females. Yeah,
no,
go on.
Not for females. And females are incredibly loud during sex, whereas men are not. And this is cross-cultural. It's not a learned cultural thing. It's a universal human thing. Females are just louder. We don't know why. But what it appears to be, and the shape of the penis seems to have something to do with this, because the shape of the human penis actually works kind of like a suction plunger. It will pull the semen of another male out so that you can replace it with your own. And what that seems to imply is that when a woman wants to have sex, she has sex with this man who then promptly conks out and goes to sleep, but she's made all this noise to attract all these other mates who then come and remove the semen from them and add their own. Now, I don't think that that's necessarily, that simple explanation is the whole thing, but it's fascinating to think that all of these factors contribute into our evolution as a species. It is absolutely fascinating.
Yep. And there's actually a really interesting book which gets into that. It's called Sex at Dawn, The History of the Prehistoric Origins of Modern Sexuality, or something like that. We'll put that in the show notes.
Great.
But that book gets into what you just talked about and talks about the research behind all of that, why we think that might be the case, and gets into its whole premise is talking about how sexuality is, or our modern view of humans as these lifelong monogamous creatures is really a very new idea and is not supported in the anthropological records that we have. And anatomy, pieces like that, that you were just talking about, some of the evidence that they use to support this idea that, you know, this isn't really, we're kind of in a mismatch. This is not how our species evolved, but we do have these cultural pressures to behave differently, and how that sometimes can create some very unhappy situations for people.
Yes.
It can really cause huge challenges in marriages. And
have you heard about the blood testing after World War II?
No.
This is kind of an amazing story. After World War II, we had the first international blood typing testing throughout the world. And so people from all over the world were blood typed. And part of what began to emerge is that ubiquitously, whether in super patriarchal controlling societies like China or in places like Scandinavia, didn't matter. 10% of the children were not the children of their supposed fathers. And what this seems to indicate is that there is a hedge factor built in to our sexuality as humans, in that women will mate with those outside of their primary relationship, so that if that guy has some kind of genetic problems, they still get their genes into the next generation. There's a terrific logic to it. It makes absolute sense. But this was so scandalous that the United States government sat on it for 20 years. Wouldn't allow these studies to be released because they indicated that there had been so much so-called infidelity throughout the whole world, and that it was more the norm than people would have assumed.
Mm-hmm.
The picture that we have of a normal family, which is this sort of nuclear mom, dad, and the kids kind of structure, it really only arose after World War II, because multi-generational families lived in single households prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
So much of what we think of as, well, I go back once again to the idea of normal, right? Mm-hmm. There ain't no normal. There just isn't. It's not out there. So a lot, going back to this question of the mainstream society, I feel that the shame and the ridicule and the castigation and the ostracizing and the, in some cases, threatening the lives of people who are, who don't fall into a given person's idea or a given culture's idea of what is acceptable sexually, is one of the great tragedies of our time. And it's well past time that we get over it. It is perfectly okay for someone to be a foot fetishist and like feet.
Yeah.
Where's the harm? Who are they hurting? Honestly, I mean, there are some limits. People need to be consenting adults.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout this conversation, I'm going to keep going back to consenting adults, because that is a very clear boundary that any society really needs to draw.
Yeah.
But this shame and guilt structure that our culture has developed around sexuality has not done a good job of protecting people who are underage. What it's done is create so much secrecy around sexuality that abusers can get away with it.
Yeah.
Because victims feel dirty. They feel shameful.
That it's their fault somehow.
Yes. Yes. That they did something dirty, even though it wasn't their fault at all.
Yeah.
So,
I think that shame, I mean, I think that that's a way that it comes back to controlling, to how it's how we control, it's how we possess other people.
And particularly and women. Particularly women more than anyone else. In a matrilineal society, it's easy. It's like, okay, the baby came out of that woman. We know that it's hers. But in a patrilineal society, it's like, oh, we've got to lock her up because we don't know.
Yeah. Well, that's some of the ideas, one of the hypotheses for how this all came about was that when these cultures emerged, that they needed some way to maintain that power, to pass it on. And so that's why we started to oppress women in that way.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
And we've been talking around it, but I just want to say explicitly, the liberation of women is a core value in my paganism. It is a core agenda of the world that I want to see. I am viscerally offended by the way women are denigrated and discounted and disrespected and devalued in our society. And
it hurts all of us.
It does.
All of us. And then, you know, we often talk about it as if it is just a woman's issue. But it's It's about all of us, right?
It's not. Okay, so our second question was, how would you describe paganism's values around sexuality?
Wow. Well, I mean, the first thing to acknowledge is that we are all coming out of or surrounded by the mainstream culture.
Yes.
And that even when we make, and I think this is wonderful, when we make conscious choices that we want to have different values, we are still working with being part of the, being brought up in our culture, being having had that culture soak into us in so many ways that we're not aware of. So that's all around us.
Yes, absolutely. The metaphor that I often use of culture is it's like tea. You're steeping in it and it's changing your color, whether you like it or not. Mm-hmm. And even if you move yourself out of the tea, you're still stained brown by it because that's what you grew up in. Mm-hmm. And it's what you're surrounded by. But for listeners, and I don't know how many of them there will be, but for listeners that are not particularly familiar with the pagan subculture, there are some very different mm-hmm. attitudes around sexuality and around relationships. And in many ways, I think those are a refreshing break. I think those are a step forward. Now, the neo-pagan explosion, particularly in the United States, started in the late 1960s and into the 1970s. And at that time, it wasn't very responsible. It was a lot of young, very horny people and a lot of sort of charismatic, assertive males getting what they wanted a lot. Mm-hmm. It was not an egalitarian system. And yet there are women that I know who were there in that era and who say, you know, I had a wonderful time and I made my own choices. And I completely respect that they got to make their own choices and that they said no when they wanted to say no and they said yes when they wanted to say yes. I think that's great. I do think that there is an inculcated habit on the part of women in our culture, especially coming out of the 50s and 60s, of not wanting to say no because you don't want to offend or being afraid to say no, all of those kinds of things.
Or that we have been taught that it's so normal that it doesn't occur that we can say no.
Yes, yes.
It's just not even part of the social script.
Right. Right.
And still today, I think it was, that was much more of an issue before, but that still is something that survives today as well.
It's true. And ironically, or maybe not ironically, maybe just obviously, many of the people that we find being most problematic in that way in the pagan community are people that have been around since the late 60s, early 70s. Mm-hmm. Many of the elders who still kind of imagine this kind of orgiastic free-for-all and don't understand the implications that hooking up can have for someone emotionally, mm-hmm. and don't respect the wishes of other people as much as they respect their own desires. But I've gotten sidetracked from the good stuff, which I think is that the pagan community has asserted a different relationship with sexuality. It has said, we are creatures of the body and that's good. And there's nothing wrong with pleasure. Pleasure is great. Mm-hmm. If no one else gets hurt, you should absolutely have as much pleasure as you possibly can, which is the most oppositional expression to Calvinism there is, right? It is the diametric opposite of the opinions of people like Luther and Calvin, saying, no, feeling good is a virtue in and of itself. It's not a means to an end. It's not something that we have to temper and control in order to keep our passions from getting away from us. All of that is a lot of nonsense. It's perfectly okay for people just to have really, really passionate pleasure. That's wonderful.
And all people.
Not just
males or men or, you know,
yes.
Everybody.
Yes.
Independent of whatever, wherever you are on the with gender or sex or any of that.
Yes, absolutely. And that is a reason why the pagan community is disproportionately filled with people who are sexual minorities, who are gays, who are lesbians, who are bisexuals, who are transsexuals, who are genderqueer or gender fluid. The pagan community contains more of those folks because we welcome them. We think they're great.
Yeah.
We don't think the idea of them having sex is icky. In fact, we do our best, despite our cultural programming, to try to imagine that sex itself isn't icky, because we were taught that. And, you know, we weren't born with it. We were taught that. And it's something that we can transcend if we really work to do so. I was reading some about Aleister Crowley today, and there's a lot there. there's a lot to say about Aleister Crowley, but one of the things that he asserted was that sexuality was the root of human power, and that therefore it was a birthright for everyone. And even though his own interpersonal behavior in relation to women was not good, and even for the time period in which he lived, it was not good. He was on to something, I think, there in the 1920s and 30s. He was on to something about how the human passionate sexual impulse is a foundation of much of what motivates us and drives our personalities and our behaviors. And I think there's a lesson to be learned there. I think there's something valuable there to be thought about. But the pagan understanding of sexuality is evolving, which is good. We have had a lot of instances of abusive elders, people who have risen to high stature in the community and have then been abusive and exploitative of others. And the community is working hard now to purge those people and to prevent that kind of behavior from going forward. There's been a lot of emphasis in conferences and events on safety and boundaries and making sure that people are protected from those that might prey on them. Arwen, you were raised in the pagan community. What would you say has been your experience around this?
Well, you know, I don't think that I've had a lot of direct experience with some of what you've been talking about with elders behaving in that way. And I think part of that is just the style of the type of people that my family would choose to be around in the first place. But I also think that overall there has been a shift away from that kind of power structure in which there are elders or authority figures in that way, and that a lot of the newer or at least the younger pagans, whether we were raised as pagans or are coming into paganism from some other tradition, are much more solitary or much more not as engaged in that and not as interested in that kind of hierarchy and power structure that lends itself to that kind of abuse.
That raises a really important issue, which is the question of power dynamics. Obviously, abuse happens most frequently in cases where someone has more power and is preying on someone who has less power. Mm-hmm. And in traditional pagan paths, like the many Wiccan paths, for example, those have been hierarchical. There are multiple degrees that one can advance, first, second, and third. Covens have a high priestess mm-hmm. that is sort of in charge of the whole thing. And there have been lots of problems around people that have been high priests or high priestesses exploiting people that have been their students or have been in covens with them and have been at a lower status level. But I agree with you. I think that what's happening with paganism now is that people are not subscribing to those hierarchical paths very much. They aren't interested in you know, being a subjugate for a year and a day so that they can learn whatever it is that the coven wants to teach them. I think they want to be autonomous sovereign beings with agency. And when I think of my idealized version of pagancy, of paganism, it is religion with agency instead of as a subject.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
When you sign on for Christianity or Judaism or Islam, you're saying, I am a subject of this powerful God, and I'm going to bow down to this powerful God and take his instruction. I see paganism as not being that way at all. That it's about us as sovereign beings saying, we're human, and that gives us the authority to make decisions in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We have the power and the right to make decisions in our lives, and that includes the power and right to say no and to say yes when opportunities are offered to us of various kinds.
Mm-hmm.
Seeing differentiates paganism from the Abrahamic religions.
Yeah. I think that I see a lot of moving in that direction, and the some of the challenges we were just discussing about those power structures and some of the abuse, I think that's not unique to paganism. It's important to say that that is not unique to paganism, that that is a symptom of the culture that we are all steeped in, that we're coming out of. Mm-hmm. And we see examples of that in other religions as well, you know, sometimes terrible examples, like some of the issues with the priests in the Catholic Church. And
yes,
but that I'm very hopeful in seeing how much people are moving away from that and being their own authorities, right? Their own personal authority.
I suspect that a part of what is leading to the culture war that's happening in the United States right now is exactly that, that younger generations are saying, I belong to me. I'm an autonomous being, and I don't subscribe to what it's supposed to be or what kind of relationship I can get into or any of that stuff. We can rewrite these rules. There's no reason why we shouldn't. We're free.
Mm-hmm.
And those who are subscribing to the old paradigm are freaking out. They're freaking out that there is gay marriage. They're freaking out that that gender is being reinterrogated and shattered from a pole, from a polar system into a spectrum. Mm-hmm. They can't handle it, and they feel very personally threatened by it because they're being told by those that they listen to that this leads to sin, death, annihilation, crisis.
Yeah. Well, and because those that they're listening to are losing their power.
Yes.
They're losing their control, right? I think some of this comes from, is a result of us having access to information now in a way that we didn't, that those people can't control all of the information. We don't have to go to them anymore if we want to learn whatever.
Right. Right.
And we can know that there's other people like us, right? That we're not so bad and different. And I mean, we are different, but that maybe the different isn't such a terrible thing. Maybe it's not such a shameful thing.
Right. And one of the ironies there, because it's certainly a very mixed topic, is that the advent of pornography, the broad spectrum availability of pornography has enabled people to see, oh, there are other people that are into this thing that I'm into, whatever it is. It doesn't matter what it is. All they have to do is put it into a search bar and they can go, oh, wow, okay. Look, other people doing exactly the thing that really gets me off. So I can't be alone, right?
Yeah.
If there's an audience for this, then I'm not alone. Then there are others. And if there are others, then I'm not abnormal.
Mm-hmm. And thus bad.
Yes. And thus bad.
Yeah.
And thus bad. Exactly. So we've talked about the pitfalls.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we talk a little bit about what's our vision for the future of sexuality through the pagan lens? If, you know, given an opportunity for things to develop as we most hope that they will, and for the problematic behaviors to be discouraged and to fade away, what would that look like? How would we get to live our lives?
Wow. I would love to see us separate out possession and sexuality. I'd love to see that as us being able to express sexuality as part of that deep part of who we are, and not have that be somehow a negative reflection upon someone else, on their them socially, or that, you know, that if I'm attracted to somebody, that doesn't mean that it somehow devalues my husband, right? Because I find someone else attractive, or, you know, because I'm a human, right? I'm an animal. And that's part of us instinctually, and I think that the more that we can work with nature and our nature, I think the happier and healthier we're going to be. That being said, though, I'm not saying that I think we should just completely get rid of the social structures that we have. You know, we grew up with some of them. There's comforting, there's purposes for them. But I'd love to see us really evaluate them and look at them more carefully and see if they're really serving us.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I think my vision is very similar in a number of ways. Certainly the decoupling of ownership the idea that I get to own somebody else's sexual behavior is really an affront to me. I find that offensive.
Yeah.
And, you know, to the degree that if my partner wants to be sexual with someone else, that I find that threatening, that's really for me to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's a reflection of some lack in myself, but probably not. Probably it just has to do with the connection between them. I feel like decoupling those things creates a social opportunity for new family structures
mm-hmm.
that is tremendously beneficial given a chance to survive. Because one of the things that we're seeing now is we've got a lot of kids that are being raised by television and the internet and little else, because mm-hmm. there isn't enough, both of the parents have to work, or maybe there's only one parent.
Yeah, if there's two, yeah.
And the children are not getting the kind of attention that they need to have. Whereas if you have a household of people that are related to one another in a variety of ways, whether it's generational or sexual or simply amicable or whatever it is, and they're all kind of raising the kids, that is so much healthier. Mm-hmm. So much healthier for the children and so much healthier for the individuals involved, because the weight on them isn't so heavy. I mean, I just can't imagine what it's like to be a single parent. I in this culture now, I just...
My heart really goes out. I mean, I'm so impressed by them.
Yes.
I have just two children with a partner who's... just super present and super on board with everything, and we don't sleep.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
So I've been encouraged by the pagan community's embrace of polyamorous mm-hmm. relationships, which doesn't mean that they can't be fucked up, because all relationships can be fucked up, because mm-hmm. that's how people are.
Yep.
But this idea about, we're married, so we're going to lock each other in a box.
Yep. And then our social status for everybody else, their view towards us is going to be affected if we do anything that deviates.
Right. Right. Yeah. So we have to perform marriage
mm-hmm.
to the people that are around us, so that they see that we are behaving according to the social strictures of what marriage is supposed to be. All of that, I think, is just sick and poisonous, yeah. and it's just not good for us.
And then we haven't even touched on all of the economic stuff that goes along with all of that. There's so much we haven't even touched on with this. We've barely even gone into gender and all of that, but yeah. But returning,
To go along with what you're saying, I mean, imagine what it's like to have three breadwinners rather than two. Or two breadwinners and someone who can stay at home with the kids all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And in the quality of the upbringing experience, it's a completely different world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one that we should be allowed to explore. It isn't for everybody. That's sure. fine. Humans have been pair bonding for a long time. Not with complete sexual exclusivity, as we talked about with the blood test
yeah.
thing, but by and large, and mostly kind of playing that out, at least during the history that we know of in the last couple thousand years. But
we think that maybe we were more serial monogamous. So we pair bond for a period of time, and then maybe transition on to being in a different pair. One of the ways that we think we might have been.
Well, particularly given that now we live so long.
Mm-hmm.
It was one thing when we married at 14 and died at 35. But now we live to 75 or 80 or 85. And the idea that we as evolving, changing people are somehow going to evolve and change in a manner that remains compatible with whoever we got together with at 15. Well, maybe, but maybe not. And that's not a failure.
Yeah.
It's just a change. So my hope is that as the pagan community grows bigger, and we can talk about respectability politics another time, but hopefully becomes more normalized,
mm-hmm.
that these kinds of family structures and relationship agreements become less outrageous in the broad stream, in the broad spectrum culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's my hope. And it seems like it's kind of happening. There's some of this happening.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the kind of frontier cultural changes that are happening, there's a lot of pagans who are part of that. Not all of that is pagans, but a lot of us are there. And I think some of that probably ties back to what you were saying before about the pagan community accepting different kinds of people.
Yes, I think that's true. And I also think that it has something to do with that fundamental endorsement of the body, mm-hmm. an endorsement of pleasure. Because, I mean, I don't have a judgment about somebody who has a boyfriend and a girlfriend. I'm like, well, good for them. That's great. You know, they're happy. Terrific. Yeah. Let them do that. That's great. You know, maybe your average Methodist is not exactly in that place. But particularly as we see participation in the Abrahamic Big Three plummeting, at least in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and the number of people that self-identify as no religion climbing, or and the number of people who are pagan climbing, which is interesting because they are. It seems to me that there is this opportunity for us to sow new ideas into the culture and have them catch fire and become normal. And I just want those ideas to be healthy ideas that are good for people, because so much of what has been given to us by the Abrahamic religions are not healthy ideas, and they're not good for people. They're not good for women. They're not good for children. They're not good for men. They're just, even, you know, even though men are supposed to be ruling the roost, they're supposed to be emotionless assholes in order to do it. And
don't get to that they have to suppress those feelings.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And,
oof. Yeah.
No, it's not my idea of a good time.
Yeah.
And I've never been very good at it. It's interesting. I did a internet personality test thing about a month ago. It was through a university. It was looking at kind of classical ideas about femininity and masculinity. Mm-hmm. And I came out 51% male, 49% female, which I thought was pretty revelatory, you know, for a guy who's a poet and a singer and religious and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, we should definitely return to, at some point, talking about gender and masculinity and femininity, because, you know, that gets very cultural.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a slow-moving tragedy happening in our society right now. I mean, the hyper-masculinity is turning up to 11 in the form of the Trump movement. Mm-hmm. And it's just, every time you think they've gotten as far as they can go, now they're saying, well, let's accept a certain number of millions of deaths so that we can rev up the economy. It's like, as far as you think they could go, they just go a little further.
Yeah.
And it's that same cold, dispassionate, uncompassionate, cruel way of looking at the world that men are supposed to embody.
Yeah. And, you know, I suspect that this is clear to our listeners, but we are not right now saying that masculinity is bad. That isn't what we're saying.
I like mine.
but that very narrow, extremely, polarized a way of expressing it, that that's the only possible form is what is being critiqued here. Not that there is not masculinity itself or femininity or anything like that.
No.
Does that?
I want people to be able to live in the fullness of themselves. And I don't believe I've ever met anyone for whom doing that really would have meant being cruel and cold and callous and disregarding of the wishes of others. Now, there are a lot of people that are really damaged.
Yeah.
And so that's how they present. And they've got a lot of layers of callousing over the soft parts inside them. But I've never met anybody that didn't have those soft parts inside them. And admittedly, there are sociopaths. There are psychopaths. The president is one of them right now. Mm-hmm. There are people that are that severely damaged that they're probably unretrievable. But that's not a role model. That's not what we should be aspiring towards. What we should be aspiring towards is for people to be able to express and live the fullness of themselves. And that's, this non-theist pagan path that I created, atheopaganism, is exactly about that. It's about people being able to be the most happy and fully expressed they can be, and the culture being one that enables them to do that in a way that's healthy and relates to the earth in a way that is sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
That all sounds a little Pollyannish, but I believe in it. I work for it every day. So those were our questions.
Yeah.
But it seems like there's just so much more to talk about.
There is. We're going to have to circle back around to this topic again.
Yes, we are.
And it's going to be bits of it'll be parts of other topics as well, right? Because it's...
Of course.
Yeah.
Because it's so central to who we are. And I have to say, to me, it is a shame that we live in a society where it isn't possible for one of us to say, well, these are the things that I find very sexually stimulating. And I'd like to dissect those because I'm trying to understand myself better. You can do that with a therapist. You can't do that on the internet.
Yeah.
You can't. It's just, it's too dangerous. It's too dangerous and too exposing. And even if you don't subscribe to shame around your sexual desires, it exposes you to just too much abuse and humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a work in progress. We work to make things better, but I hope that through this podcast and the various other ways we communicate, that we're able to lay out the opportunities of a better way of relating to sexuality and ourselves.
Yeah. Well, and I really appreciate having this conversation with you, Mark. And for everyone listening, listening and sticking with us through this.
I've really enjoyed it. I always enjoy talking with you, Arwen. Thank you so much. Remember, if you have questions that you would like to submit to the Wonder Podcast, the email address is thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. And we look forward to getting your inquiries and your questions and topic suggestions, all of that. All of those are helpful to us as we develop new episodes. So until then, we'll see you next time.